Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So Congress is getting into the act in a bigger way now on whether to take military action against Syria. In a few minutes, we'll talk to Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal, who tends to be a hawk despite being a liberal Democrat. Texas Republican Ted Cruz is demanding the president go through them.
Secretary Kerry and the president have said they want to go to the United Nations for approval. How about going to the United States Congress? You know, the Constitution gives Congress the authority to declare war, and this president doesn't seem to view it as remotely a priority to go to Congress to make the case why any military action is in our national security, and I think that's his responsibility.
Senator Ted Cruz. We'll get two more takes on Syria now from Michael Weiss, columnist for Now Lebanon and editor-in-chief of the Interpreter magazine. He also wrote an article in Foreign Affairs called How to Oust Assad. And Andrew Tabler, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and author of the book In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. He has a foreign affairs article called The Day After Assad Wins. Thanks to both of you for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
A pleasure.
And Michael Weiss, the premise of your title, How to Oust Assad, suggests that regime change could be the goal in Syria, not just an attack to destroy some of his military capability in retaliation for using chemical weapons. Is regime change a scenario that the White House is considering, as far as you can tell?
Well, I think it's important to remember it's the articulated policy of President Obama going back to the summer of 2011 when he'd called for Assad to step down. Ever since then, the United States, based on growing reluctance to get deeper involved in the conflict, has sort of revised and rescinded that policy. But I think, look, what the U.S. has now recognized is that these chemical stockpiles, which are some of the largest in the Middle East and in the world, are not safe in the hands of this regime. The U.K. today came out with its intelligence assessment saying that there have been 14 separate instances of chemical weapons use in Syria, all of them by Assad's forces, and, of course, the most devastating of which happened last Wednesday. I argue, look, this is not an Iraq-style intervention. This is not boots on the ground. This is not a decade-long occupation. And there are several key factors that militate against any kind of thesis that would argue we should go, sort of back to 2003 here. The first of which is it's actually not difficult to do something that would help shift the tide or the balance of power on the ground. And I argue, and this is based on a report that the Institute of the Study of War, a D.C. think tank, has come out with, you don't even need a no-fly zone for Syria. Syria has about 6 air bases left that are full use, meaning that these are the planes that take off and land the most regularly. And while it's true, as General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said, that only about 10% of all fatalities in Syria are caused by the air campaign, what that fact leaves out is a more important aspect of the conflict, which is Assad is completely reliant on foreign resupplies from Iran, from Russia, and all of this stuff, or the majority of this stuff, is being flown into the country. So it's simple. If you take out the runways and the airfields and the control towers, the planes have nowhere to land and nowhere to take off. And that would essentially, it's what I call regime isolation. Doesn't mean the government's going to be overthrown overnight or toppled overnight. In fact, I don't advocate that because I don't think the opposition is quite there yet. However, concomitant with that is you have to have a strategy. What is the day after? Who's going to inherit this government?
I'm going to jump in for a minute because we're going to go live to the House of Commons, the British Parliament. Ed Miliband is speaking right now. He's the Labour Party leader. About the roadmap to intervention. They're having a very hot debate in the UK. Listen.
And its allies to set out that case. Now, there'll be some in this House who say that Britain should not contemplate action, even when it is limited, because we do not know precisely the consequences that will follow. I'm not, as I said, with those who rule out action. The horrific events unfolding in Syria do ask us to consider all the options available. But here is the point, Mr. Speaker. I just want to make a bit more progress. We owe it to the Syrian people, to our own country, and to the future security of our world to scrutinise any plans on the basis of the consequences that they have. And by setting the framework today, we give ourselves the time and space to actually scrutinise what is being proposed by the government to see what the implications are. I give way to the honourable gentleman.
Just for the sake of clarity for the House, can the right honourable gentleman tell us, if there was no UN security resolution, would the Labour opposition back military intervention?
It depends on the case that has been set out and the extent to which an international support has been developed. And look, the honourable gentleman opposite making strange noises. Look, I've got to say to them, it is right to go about this process in a calm and measured way. If people are asking me today to say yes, now let us take military action, I'm not going to say that. But nor am I going to rule out military action, because we have to do so on the basis of evidence and the basis of the consensus and the support that can be built. I give way.
Wow. Well, they have much better floor debates in the UK than we do, I can tell you that. Ed Miliband, the Labour Party leader, and someone questioning him in the middle of that. Andrew Tabler, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. What do you make of what we just heard? I think that, for one thing, given the centrality of getting the UK on board for whatever action the United States decides to take, but that indicates to me that we're at least days away from having that ally.
There seems to be a delay in the action regarding enforcing the, quote, red line with the Assad regime on chemical weapons use. And every moment that goes by, it becomes more problematic for the Obama administration. The Assad regime is a master at creating ambiguity and doubt among its adversaries. And of course, they know very well, and they track very well, the uncertainty among Western populations about intervention in the Middle East based off of the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction issue and the evidence for it. Despite the fact that in Syria we have a lot of evidence, just not only the presence of chemical weapons, but on their use. So, Iraq and Syria aren't the same situations, but anyways, it's going to be up to the British government now to try and to maneuver through this. And it's creating quite a spectacle, as your piece just demonstrated.
Here is President Obama on PBS last night arguing that a military strike on Syria is not just to protect the Syrian people from chemical weapons, but for the sake of the United States.
We want the Assad regime to understand that by using chemical weapons on a large scale against your own people, against women, against infants, against children, that you are not only breaking international norms and standards of decency, but you're also creating a situation where U.S. national interests are affected, and that needs to stop.
The president last night on PBS. So, Michael Weiss, how much do you buy that notion that U.S. national security interests are at stake in a day after Assad wins scenario?
Yeah. I mean, I think no doubt there is a deep concern here that forget about even what the regime is up to, but Syria has become now a haven for global jihadist forces. And there is a grave concern, particularly among European powers, that there is a mid-level or mid-term security threat to their countries. I've taken the trip to southern Turkey, and I've been inside Syria, and I know how easy it is to transgress that border. A foreign fighter who links up with al-Qaeda can do the same thing and then can board a plane from Istanbul to anywhere in the world. So these are sort of long-term consequences, long-term problems, I think, that the U.S. needs now to carefully calculate in its response. But beyond even that, let's look at the neighborhood. Every single country that surrounds Syria has experienced what is called spillover effect or spillover violence. It has been – there are people who have been shot on every side every other side of the border. Turkey – I did a tour of southern Turkey going about 15 kilometers inside the country, just north of Latakia, which is the Assad's ancestral province. And you can see the entire mountainsides are completely charred by artillery shells that have come across the border. In fact, Turkey downplays the extent to which the violence has spilled over. So there is a very credible and clear threat to the security of this region. And let's put it this way. As sensitively placed as Iraq was, Syria is, I mean, it is the mother of all keystone states.
But Andrew Tabler, in your foreign affairs article the day after foreign affairs article the day after Assad wins, the alternative scenario is the rebels take over. Or even if Assad wins, the rebels continue to control large swaths of the country. So there's an al-Qaeda presence. And the parts that are controlled by Assad have a kind of more permanent and more official alignment with Iran than in the past. So how are Americans supposed to decide which is actually more safe for long-term American interests and regional interests, given the dangers that Michael Weiss just laid out?
Right. I mean, that article, I think, dovetails with a lot of what Michael was saying. What we're going from, in a policy sense, is from Syria going from a state sponsor of terrorism and a united country into three Syrias in which U.S.-designated terrorist organizations are not just present, but they're ascendant. So it's triple the threat. In the regime areas, we have Hezbollah very prevalent and also backed up by Iran. In the Sunni Arab areas, we have al-Qaeda and their affiliates and other extremists. And in the Kurdish areas, an offshoot of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, another designated terrorist organization. So there's a strategic threat from that, just emanating out of that structure itself. And then there's the spillover effect, as Michael talked about. This is not the arguments out in the press that, okay, well, let's just let these different factions fight it out and we'll stay out of it. You know, this sort of dual containment two strategy only works if it doesn't spill over Syria's borders. And Michael's already discussed this. It already has. Whether it's in the number of refugees who are displaced, the cross-border fighting, and chemical weapons and their use and other strategic weapons use in Syria makes this worse, because around Syria are many, many U.S. allies, Turkey, Iraq, where we've dumped billions of dollars, Jordan, Israel. So I use a different metaphor than Michael's, but it's very similar. People say that the conflict in Syria is akin to that which happened in Lebanon in the 70s and 80s. Well, it's true. There are some of the same players, but for all the horror that happened there, Lebanon was the small row house on the end of the block, and the destruction and the blaze in that row house was contained by a strong Israel and a much stronger and demographically different Syria. Syria is the big row house in the middle of the block. And what happens there affects all of the bloc. And the bloc here is the metaphor for the region's security architecture. We have a lot invested in that, in terms of our, not only in terms of our allies. So, the effect that actions happen there affect the price of energy in the United States.
Still, members of Congress are now getting into the act, demanding that they be consulted and shown concrete evidence. The British Parliament, too, as we just heard in that live stretch that we took, slowing this whole rush to military action, and this issue that no one has yet presented evidence that Assad or his armies did this is rearing its head. But here's another clip of the president on PBS last night seeming to present one piece of evidence, or at least stating that it exists, pertaining to the delivery systems for the chemical weapons.
We do not believe that, given the delivery systems using rockets, that the opposition could have carried out these attacks. We have concluded that the Syrian government, in fact, carried these out. And if that's so, then there need to be international consequences.
So is that evidence, Michael Weiss, or is that just talk?
Well, no, I think what the president is doing is alluding to quite a great deal of evidence, some of which is now in open source media and can be read by anyone. Today, in fact, they have isolated, or they have found, the exact rocket delivery system that carried these chemical warheads, and they have found that they're Iranian-made. And we actually have video evidence of Syrian soldiers, including the Republican Guard, which is one of Assad's two Praetorian divisions, not loading these munitions for the purpose of the Ghouta attack that happened on Wednesday, but doing so at a prior date. So it's all about who actually is in control of what kind of materiel. And another important point to note about this is nerve agents, toxic gas, particularly sarin gas, these are not things that the local mujahideen can very ably outfit into a rocket or artillery shell. They require a technical expertise and a level of know-how that I think at this stage it's quite clear that the Assad regime only possesses itself. Added to which, there is just sort of commonsensical things like, why would the rebels gas themselves? an eyewitness testimony from on the ground. I mean, we've all seen those videos. You know, these symptoms are not faked. You know, blood and tissue samples.
Could they get this? Could they gas themselves to draw this international response, which benefits them in the long run?
I mean, look, the area that was hit, East Ghouta, is a very entrenched rebel location, actually more entrenched than I had anticipated. And I've been looking into this and reporting on it for a bit now. The reason they were hit and the reason these specific villages in this or towns in this area were hit is because this is what the rebels have been using to advance. And just to give you perspective, you know, let's say in, you know, the Upper West Side, you know, we have enemy forces, you know, kind of combined up there. And we're sitting here and we've thrown everything we can at them, including, by the way, chemical weapons in the past, artillery, scuds, rockets, and we still can't dislodge them. So what do? We wage a spectacular to basically just completely terrorize the population and drive them out. And even that, by the way, Brian, has failed. These rebels are still in East Ghouta, and they're still battling the regime. And in fact, Walid Mualim, the foreign minister of Syria, one of the things the regime has done is it has admitted that it was waging a conventional military campaign in this area. In fact, they announced and launched that campaign the day of the chemical attack.
We're running out of time, and we have Senator Blumenthal standing by. But you're saying if all the conventional means have failed, and this is so central to Assad's success,
right,
it's worth the risk to him.
I mean, these guys are at the doorstep of the lion's den. And so for him, if for Damascus to fall, would be game over Assad. And he cannot afford to have that happen.
Well, I want to thank Michael Weiss, who is columnist for Now Lebanon. Obviously, he has traveled through the area recently. He's editor-in-chief of The Interpreter magazine, and he wrote an article in Foreign Affairs called How to Oust Assad. And Andrew Tabler from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, author of the book In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. And he has a Foreign Affairs article called The Day After Assad Wins. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And we will ask Senator Blumenthal next, does the president need to go through him and his colleagues in Congress before doing anything militarily in Syria? Stay with us.